Hello and welcome to Coast AM. I am Lisa Garr. So we've spoken on the show before about near-death experiences, NDEs, the afterlife, other psychic phenomenons. We just spent the last couple hours talking with a channel. But have you ever heard of shared death, a shared death experience? It takes a very special person, a very skilled person to assist the soul into the afterlife, kind of to usher them into the afterlife and then to return to that, for that person to return, not the person that's crossing over. But William Peters is this person. He teaches shared death and shared crossings through his program. And he himself is not a stranger to near-death experiences. He's had a couple of them. And it seems that his soul, William Peter's soul, really wanted to know more. He wanted to know more. He wanted to find out what it was like on the other side, and then really just to help people cross over. Very, very interesting conversation we're about to have here about shared crossings. We will be right back with that conversation and William Peters. This is Lisa Garr, and you're listening to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast AM. A while ago, I did this great summit called the Afterlife Summit, and I really found that my interviews with other people who had near-death experiences really went to another level. They kind of started at the level 10 and went up from there. And so I decided to do a whole series around it. And you can find that at theawareshow.com/afterlife. Great, great summit I did about 20 interviews. One of the interviews that I did was with this gentleman, William Peters, and I had never heard of shared crossings before. And I can't remember how I came across William, but I do know that he was probably one of the most profound interviews that I had, because I didn't know that you could actually assist a soul into the afterlife in a dignified, graceful end of life experience. Beautiful, beautiful concept. William Peters is joining me today on the show. Thank you for joining me, William.
Thank you for having me, Lisa.
Absolutely. So I'd love to start with your story. You, at 17 years old, you've had several near-death experiences. Tell us a little bit about the first two, and it seemed you just kept trying to leave.
That makes sense. My first near-death experience was when I was 17 years old, and it was a typical day skiing at Lake Tahoe, and I was bolting down the mountain, and I caught an edge on my skis. And normally I would be able to kind of correct my skis and keep on going, but that is not what happened. I was catapulted into the air, sailed for a long period of time. It was exhilarating until I realized this wasn't going to have a good ending. And I landed really hard on the snow, and my ski bindings did not release. So my low back took the brunt of the force, fractured two lumbars in my lower spine, and then also crushed into my sacroiliac joint.
Ooh.
And I was, like I said, catapulted out of my body. The next thing, well, really what happened first is, this is very interesting from an energetic perspective, is my whole body went dark. I mean, it literally felt like, I don't know if you've ever watched I'm sure your listeners have, that the show MASH used to have, when the bombing would come in the war, and all the lights would go off, and it would just be dark for a few seconds. Well, that's the way it felt to me, is all the lights, all the energy just shut down. And then the next thing I knew, I was sailing away from my body, looking down at my body in the snow, and then I was moving away from the earth. And I could see, Lake Tahoe, near the ski area. Then I could see San Francisco Bay. I could see the Colorado, the Rocky Mountains there, eventually continental United States. And soon I was into this great cosmos, and I was enthralled. It was absolutely beautiful, spectacular. And as this was going on, I then noticed that my life was being played back before me. And this is the well-known life review mm-hmm. and the near-death experience. And then I sailed into this tunnel, also a classic feature of the near-death experience, mm-hmm. still very enamored. And then I saw the light. And the light, this beautiful, glorious light, actually my response to the light is not typical. I realized I was dying and I did not want to die. And at that point, I remember pleading with, I grew up Catholic, so I was pleading directly with God, which I had projected onto the light, and said, I don't want to die. I haven't done my life's work. I need to return. This did not stop my trajectory into the light, but when I got into the light and was fully surrounded by the light and felt the warmth and the love, it was, it's ineffable. It's just beyond anything I've ever experienced. I still had that desire to return. And the light pushed back on me and started me heading the other way and said, there's not words here, but this is what I received. Make something of your life. And I started sailing back the other direction. Everything was in reverse. And I remember seeing planet Earth again and wondering, how am I going to get back in that body? How am I going to find my way? And then I realized I was being fully guided. And I, landed back in my body, and I didn't have any feeling at all. And I kind of, once again, almost screamed, God, don't let me be paralyzed. And feeling came back into my body.
Oh, my goodness.
Almost as if I was under a shower of warm water, and you have that sensation of feeling coming across your body. And it was like warmth, and I was said, thank you. What I should have asked for, in retrospect, is that that my body was fully functional. I, as a result of that injury, I suffered from chronic pain for 30 years, 35 years, in fact.
Wow.
Quite debilitating. And we can talk about that if it comes up later.
Well,
but that was my first near-death experience, and I did not talk about that
right.
For 10 years. I was a typical, suburban kid and had no context to bring it up.
Well, and we usually don't because it's so shocking, and sometimes you forget about it completely. But then what's interesting is that you went back and judged yourself. Oh, what I should have asked was, there's no thinking in that state. There's no analytical consequential mind in that state. No, you had that incredible experience, and that was, it takes years to digest, to even understand, to comprehend what happened.
Well, yeah, you're absolutely correct in that, that they know from the research now of near-death experiencers and experiencers of shared death experiences, and even, a full array of other extraordinary spiritual experiences, mm-hmm. That it can take, and it tends to take an average of 7 years for people to process and integrate and kind of get settled in their new understanding, comprehension of their own life, their sense of their existence in the larger cosmos, if you will. All this takes time, since it's, as we all know, it's our world, our current, shared conventional reality doesn't really know how to make sense of these near-death experiences.
So then you decided to have another one of these experiences, but in a different way. Let me ask you, did you have this quest to want to get back to that space ever?
Well, that's a great question. I actually didn't. And part of that might be because I didn't even think of it. I mean, I remember waking up, in those kind of liminal states in the morning, just before you fully awaken to your reality of your identity. And I think it was I know it was in my dream life too, but just as I was waking up, I'd be remembering my dreams, and I would occasionally remember the near-death experience. But as soon as I came fully into my identity as William, I forgot about it. And so I don't ever remember wanting to go back to that state. In fact, it isn't till the last, well, I part of my story is in about a decade ago, I moved to Brazil to be in the John of God community. And it was there that I actually fully rediscovered those experiences and remembered how profound they were, and actually gave myself the opportunity to experience them fully again. And there came the appreciation for those experiences. Not so much the desire to return to them, because I had actually now was having different experiences that I was really pleased with. So I didn't have that. But you're right, Lisa. Most people who have the NDE will often live in a sense of yearning or longing to return to that euphoric state.
Right, right. Well, so after you had this experience and you maybe, I think, I don't know how long it was afterwards, but you found yourself at the Zen Hospice Project. Well, you actually did a little bit of time in a global journey after college. You worked abroad for a little while. Tell us a little bit about that experience when you came back.
So, while I did not, kind of hold on to that experience of the NDE, the first one, mm-hmm. I said, I didn't really remember it. I am really sure that that experience transformed me in ways that I wasn't conscious of. So at that point, I was, went to college, and then soon after graduating, I made a rather radical decision for the typical trajectory of a suburban, upper middle class young man, and I decided to work in the third world, the developing world. And a part of that was because I was in so much pain, I kind of had a simple-minded response saying, I need to be with people who are experiencing pain and suffering. I didn't know that, but I was very drawn to them. I actually had a trip between my junior and senior years in college to Europe, and I was in Greece, and I wanted to go up to the Iron, what we used to call the Iron Curtain, to Eastern Europe. And I said, on our guidebook, there was no map of Yugoslavia, which was then Yugoslavia. Today, it's Bosnia and other countries in that area. But we realized there had to be a way to get up there, and so we took an overnight bus ride, me and a couple friends. And I woke up in the middle of poverty, literally. We were in a very poor part of southern Yugoslavia, and I opened the bus door, opened, and I looked out, and there were, as far as I could see, thousands of Muslim women with their burqas on. All I could see was their eyes, these deep brown eyes, and their hands begging, their arms begging for food or anything. It was very clear that they were, begging. And this touched my heart very deeply. And my immediate response was, I need to be with people like this. I need to know what this experience is. Now, once again, I just knew it. That's the way I expressed it. Many years later, I learned that I was suffering so much in physical pain that I needed to learn how to be with it and how to express it and how to connect with myself and others around it. So with that, I went to Central and South America, and the experiences I had there, because I ended up in Guatemala and Peru in the middle of two civil wars. This was the late 80s. There I saw a great deal of poverty, suffering, some violence, certainly a great deal of death. And it was there that I saw my first real experiences, mystical experiences around death. And I was a lot, because the cultures there are indigenous, the Aymara Indians, there was always that field of shamanic understanding around the deaths of the indigenous people who were caught in the middle of the Civil War. So that was really part of my introduction into the mystical aspects of death. And then after that, I came back to the United States, took a position as a social worker.
Wait, you have to tell us, what are the what mystical experiences of death did you experience?
Oh, well, you know, at the most basic level, I was struck by how the shamans and the elders were not nearly as shocked and appalled and in pain as the Westerners. There weren't a lot of Westerners there. This was a very liberal Catholic mission that was helping, you know, the poor in southern Peru. But the shamans, who we were ostensibly, you know, helping their communities, they were very casual, not unconcerned. They were not equanimous about this. But in the face of death, they held a great deal of, I won't even say hope. It was much more secure and confident than hope. It was a knowing that that we're all on a journey, that this human life is just part of a larger journey. And I remember a shaman coming up to me as I was with a young boy who was suffering from hepatitis. And he didn't die from this, but his father did, actually. But there was a great, I was really, you know, very upset by this. And he put his hand on my shoulder, and he looked at me and smiled with his deep, dark eyes and just looked at me and said, you know, no te preocupes, don't worry. El viaje es largo, the voyage is long, the viaje is the trip. The trip is long, and this is only one stop.
Wow.
And that was just, I looked at him, and he was really gentle, loving. It was an invitation for me to step out of my kind of Western
view of death, yes.
Yeah, my fear-based view of death.
Mm.
So that was my first step. Definitely, that opened me quite a bit.
Yes, I see what you're saying. So that stepped you outside of the fear-based view of death and into a different, that kind of opened your mind for what you've then found yourself back in, back in San Francisco, right?
Yes, I took a position at St. Anthony's Foundation as a social worker. And I was a direct service social worker. So people that would have very acute, you know, problems or challenges, I would be their first person they'd meet with. Well, I was hired because I spoke Spanish, and there was an influx of, you know, Central Americans primarily and Mexicans coming into the United States at that time, into California and then moving up the coast. But what happened at this time was the AIDS epidemic broke out, as we call it, now look back on it, and there were increasing numbers of primarily gay men with the HIV virus, and there was no cure for AIDS at that time, for the HIV virus, and these deaths were quite gruesome in the early days, and there was a great deal of fear around the HIV virus. I, for reasons I cannot explain to you, I felt okay around it. I just didn't feel like it was contagious, or I don't know. And maybe I just didn't have a fear of death, period, at that point. So I would be invited and was invited to join communities, primarily, like I said, of gay men at the bedsides of the dying. And it was there that I experienced these mystical experiences, which we now, you know, the shared death experience being the primary experience, which is where somebody at the bedside of a loved one will express that they felt like they went into the initial stages of the afterlife with their loved one or friend. And I was privy to a few of these experiences, but what happened more than anything else was, this is the most common experience, because I was a mental health worker and a trusted social worker and you know, kind of a psychotherapist in this area of San Francisco,
Wait.
many of these men would come to me and share their stories.
Okay,
They
well, we're going to
wanted
have
to
to take a
know, are
quick
they going crazy?
we have to take a quick break here, William. We're going to be right back, and you can continue this story. Very interesting story about shared death experiences. We will be right back. This is Lisa Gar. You're listening to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast AM. We are going to get back to my guest, William Peters. He has quite a fascinating story that we're in the middle of right now, but I want to get back to his story after this break. In the meantime, you can go to the website, which is theawareshow.com/afterlife, and you will see that there are many, many guests there that I have interviewed, including Raymond Moody, who is one of William's teachers, and talking about various elements that have been pulled out of the near-death experience. And there's themes that you'll hear throughout these interviews. One specifically was a profound change of life where there's a different mission, a passion that you just can't deny, can't not do, have to do. Very interesting themes that were pulled out of the Afterlife Summit. So that's theawareshow.com/afterlife. And we will be right back with William Peters' story. This is Lisa Gar again, and we will be right back listening to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast AM. My guest is William Peters, and we're talking about shared death and shared crossings. William, we were in the middle of a story talking about how you had a second near-death experience in the ICU when you became very sick, and this was in San Francisco. Can you tell us a little bit about that experience?
Yeah, I contracted a blood disease called idiopathic thrombocytopenia. It's idiopathic means no known cause, and it's basically a hemophiliac condition. I didn't have clotting capacity in my blood. And I went into the emergency room because I saw the signs for, as I say, ITP, and they put a fall alert on me, and the next thing I realized, my next point of consciousness was I was floating above my body on the 10th floor of the ICU in actually Kaiser Oakland Hospital. And I was very much at peace. I was curious. I was looking around. I listened to the conversations of nurses, went down the hall and looked at the janitors doing their late night routines, because this happened between probably 2 and 6 in the morning. And I remember a moment when the doctor came in who was attending to me, and I saw him. I looked at him from above. I actually saw the top of his head, and he went over to my bed and he said, Mr. Peters, I'm Dr. So and so, and can you wake up? And I remember having this really profound question. I said, you know, I could. If I answered his question, you know, would I come back into my body, or if I didn't say anything, I'd just stay up here? And I remember realizing, you know, I could stay up there. But then I said, well, I'll just answer the question. So at the moment I started talking, I just kind of said yes, and my body started to fill in with awareness and consciousness. And then I opened my eyes and I looked at him, and I was fully back in my body. And that experience was one that clearly taught me that I am not this body, that any part of me that I would call the deepest part of myself is not related or not dependent upon this physical body. And that was an experience that I've obviously never forgotten, but it has shaped the way I see the human experience and beyond. It's like so many of us who have these near-death experiences or shared crossings. These aren't belief systems anymore. These are knowings. It's a real. We see this in our research all the time, that when our participants talk about their experiences, they'll get serious and focused and say, "Yeah, I know I go on beyond this life. I know
Yeah.
I'm there's an eternal aspect of myself. I know that I'll see my deceased loved ones again. And I had that experience. You know, I'm not overly opinionated about it, but it's definitely a now part of my understanding, deep understanding of myself and the human experience.
So at what point were you able to see other souls when you were going in and out of consciousness or in and out of your body like that? At what point were you able to actually see the souls of the people that were crossing over?
So when I worked in Zen Hospice, which was about 10 years after I had my second near-death experience, but in that time my grandmother died, and I experienced her basically having what we now know as pre-death visions or pre-death dreams. I walked into her home. It wasn't her home. She was living in a skilled nursing facility at that time. And she was very adamantly involved in a deep conversation. It almost as if she had a bubble around her, so, like she was in a different dimension, because I walked in, she didn't even recognize me, and I could feel like a boundary. And I just started taking notes on what she was saying, because I knew my grandmother. Something was under her skin, and she was working it out. And I took down the names of the people she was talking to, went to the elder in our family, my uncle, and went through all the names that I heard and what they were talking about, and boy, his jaw dropped and said, you know, William, that happened 50 years ago. Mm. Those are factual events that always seem to rile your grandmother. And he was just like, and we shared this together, like, wow, it seems like she was in direct communication with these deceased relatives. And so after that experience, I couldn't let go of, there was something very profound happening at the end of a human life. So I joined Zen Hospice, and one afternoon in Zen Hospice, I was at the bedside of a man, we'll call him Ron, and I used to read him Merchant Marines. He was a Merchant Marine, and I used to read him Jack London stories. He loved hearing the adventure of a Jack London story. And one afternoon, I was reading, and all of a sudden, I popped out of my body, and I was looking down at my body and Ron's body, and Ron was suspended right up next to me. And we looked at each other, and I was flabbergasted, really taken back by this. But he was very calm, and he smiled at me in the way that you do that there, a real warmth, as if to say, check this out. And that was one of the first experiences, and this is a shared death experience. It's a shared out-of-body experience. And this is when I realized that this is what's happening to people at the end of life, because Ron went back into his body. He died a few days later. But I would have many, many more experiences similar to this. I had some shared out-of-body experiences, but I also felt like presences in the room of people. I just felt like as people got closer to death, the room would fill with, any hospice worker will tell you this, there's a thickness that comes, and there's an energetic fullness that comes into the space surrounding the dying. And we call this the presences of deceased loved ones and friends, serving as a welcoming party or a guide.
Preparing you, maybe, yes.
Pardon me?
Preparing you, maybe, to move.
Preparing, yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Making this, comforting the dying as they're about to, you know, drop their human body. And there are many of us. I mean, there's a deep tradition in humanity that's called a psychopomp. It's one who can actually serve as a guide to take the human soul from the human body into the afterlife, into the next dimension, if you will. And psychopomps are adept at going between these different dimensions. And so I am aware now that my two near-death experiences, as well as some other profound spiritual experiences, but really the two near-death experiences really taught me the geography of this land, if you will, from the human realm into the afterlife. And there's signposts, and the signposts aren't visual per se. Most of it is very sensorial. And there's just knowings that kind of land in my being, in my consciousness, that say there's something happening here, or now's the time, and there's information that comes with these kind of downloads, if you will, into my consciousness. And I want to be really clear. I am not alone in this. There are a great deal of people, even in our Western culture, that speak about this. The sad part about our culture is that most people who, and still today, even though 70% of Americans prefer to die at home and not in a medicalized setting, still two-thirds of Americans die in hospitals. And in those settings, they're not very friendly to these experiences. And
oh, yes.
And so they'll, you know, I can't say that a blanket statement for every, say, hospital or medical setting in which someone will die in, but there certainly isn't the appreciation for the journey that is taking place, the great transition that these souls are embarking on.
So is this what you take people through as their end of life? Do you really literally take their soul into the afterlife?
Well, you know,
not
what
literally,
I do with the Shared Crossing Project is I teach people a number of things. I teach them how to prepare their soul for this journey. So a lot of that is dealing with the unfinished business that we all have as human beings. You know, regrets and remorse and the woulda, coulda, shouldas in our lives. And I use the great spiritual practices, East and West. So we do, you know, compassion for ourselves, forgiveness, eventually gratitude arises. And we really step in our, you know, if I'm working with a family, if I'm working with a group, it's always the same set of steps that we set into a conscious connection with our loved ones that acknowledges that we are going to die. One of us is going to die at some point, and we express what needs to be said. We express our love, our appreciation, our regrets. We get it all out. So we're now, our souls are unencumbered from our human experience, good, bad, and indifferent. And at that point, I then teach the pathway that leads from this human life into the afterlife. And that's through guided visualizations. I take people through a series of steps, reminding them about what they'll see. And you know, by the way, you know, I'm one of the few doing it in the West, but there are great traditions, indigenous and certainly Tibetan Buddhists have a whole set of protocols as well. But I've westernized it so that I teach people how to let go, how to, you know, release from their body, how to turn to the light, how to be receptive to the various experiences they're going to have, and most importantly, how to call their their remaining surviving loved ones and to pull them into the afterlife where they are, to show them where they are, and to show their surviving loved ones that they're safe, that they're well cared for, and that they're happy.
How can you give me an example of that, of what that is like?
Yeah, sure. I mean, you know, so the shared death experience is really, and Raymond and Moody and I and other researchers are now clear that the shared death experience is identical to the near-death experience. So the phenomena are the same. Every experience is unique, but the phenomena are largely the same. So if you were if you had the shared death experience and you went into the afterlife with, say, your mother, you could be there with your mother and you could see her life as she lived it revealed to you. You would see her childhood. You would see the most formative experiences in her life. And you would see her go through, you know, her entire life. Now, curiously about this, we know that some parts of the life review are shielded, and the viewer actually realizes that, oh, I'm not supposed to see that. It's blocked from me. And then
Mm-hmm.
kind of the screen comes up, if you will, and you get to see more of the life review. So there are some things that are kept out of it. But what the viewer, the shared death experiencer, receives is profound appreciation and love for their now departed loved one. And they will say things like, I now know why my mother was maybe critical of me or fearful of that. And I have such appreciation for her. So that's just one phenomenon that someone would experience. Sometimes they'll be in the afterlife and their loved one, the one who's dying, will be there, and all of a sudden these deceased loved ones, friends, maybe family members will show up, and the shared death experiencer will recognize them, and their
and start talking
will be,
to
oh
them.
My, this is wonderful. Your father's here. Your sister's
right.
here.
Yes.
You know, your best friend's here. You are in good hands. I can see that all is well. And then usually the one dying, leaving, will turn to the remaining loved one and give them a very clear sign. It is time for you to return. I will be going on. And the one experiencing, having the shared death experience, will go back to their human life. And then they'll have a whole experience to integrate all this. But generally speaking, and we know this, that the overwhelming majority, upwards of 90% of the shared death experiencers, will feel gratitude for this experience,
mm-hmm.
a
mm-hmm.
peace and settledness that their loved one is alive and well, that they'll see them again. They have an appreciation for their own life. They usually come back with a renewed understanding and commitment to make meaning of their life, to live.
I've actually experienced this, something like
it.
This, when I went through this with my husband's grandmother, and she started speaking to her deceased husband, and hearing bells and so forth, and really having this peaceful communication with, it looked like the other side from what I could tell, and it was like she was going in and out of this experience. Now, have you ever been able to go and see these other people that they speak to without knowing them?
Yes, I will feel these presences in the room. I don't, sometimes I see them, but more than anything else, I sense and feel them. And I can even sense the relationship. So I can feel if it's a parent or a friend or a sibling. There's just some sense of knowing the level of connection, if you will. It helps, quite frankly, if I have a relationship with the person dying, because then I feel like I have more access to their field, if you will,
mm-hmm.
more access into their consciousness. Also, if I'm there with somebody, if I just know the caregiver, loved one, likewise, I can be brought in that way, because there's a whole field that's created here, and I really believe that's what happens, is that our energetics, if you will, our frequencies, because we're energetic beings, they get attuned and grooved. Basically what happens is they rise up. The frequency rises up,
yeah.
The vibration rises up, and then you're able to access these spirit dimensions, if you will, these higher disincarnate dimensions. And in that space, when you go in there, then you can sense and feel the relationships in there.
So
it's really important not to be kind of limited by using the six senses that we have as in the human body, because most of us who do this work will say there's just knowing, and it's beyond
You actually teach this to people, right?
Pardon me?
You actually teach to people how to do this, how to...
We do teach attunement. Mm-hmm. We do teach how to attune to these different frequencies.
Mm-hmm. And now, what is the difference between a shared death experience and a shared crossing?
Yes. So So a shared cross. So, when I was doing, I first got focused on how to facilitate the shared death experience for people. But as I started doing the trainings, and I had a researcher from UCSB joining in this, actually a couple of researchers, doing collecting the data, we started realizing in our qualitative assessments that people were having a whole host of other experiences. And these experiences were like pre-death premonitions, pre-death dreams and visions. Another experience is terminal lucidity, this ability to exhibit physiologically impossible behavior. So blind people see, people with
Oh my
dementia
goodness.
have
Well,
great memories.
you know what we're going to do, William? We're going to take a quick break again, and when we come back, I want to find out what these things are. What are pre-death dreams, pre-death premonitions? I want to find out a little bit about that. When we come back, this is Lisa Gar. You're listening to Coast to Coast AM.